Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. We have a really full agenda today, as we were just discussing. We're going to go out of order because most people are here for Senate Bill 213, so we want to make room to get the smaller groups of people out first, but I am going to temporarily open a public hearing on Senate Bill 213 and invite up Senator Elizabeth Snyder Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17 and also a family physician. When I came to the legislature, my first session was the 2012 session, and that was a session in which we passed the legislation that basically laid the groundwork for the early learning hubs. And it was a really, really exciting time for me to be here and to be thinking about coordinating services to very young children in this state across multiple disciplines. And that's exactly what the early learning hubs have been doing ever since, and they're getting stronger and stronger every day. So one of the reasons that Senate Bill 213 is so important to me is because of what we know about early childhood development. And we know that there's an enormous amount of brain development, and that's not just the actual intelligence side of it, but it's emotional intelligence, it's social bonding, it's all the things that you need to be a successful human being in this world that happen even before age 3, and certainly before our kids start kindergarten at age 5. So having care, the right kinds of services available in those first 1,000 days of life, from the time you're born until you hit that 1,000-day mark, right around your third birthday, is really, really important for queuing kids up, teeing kids up for success. And we talk in this state about our 40-40-20 goal, and that's really important, but the reality is unless kids come to kindergarten ready to learn, which the early learning hubs allow them to do and get them ready to do, we could pour a gazillion dollars, to use a technical term, into K-12 education.
Gazillion.
You like that now, Senator? Yeah. We could pour an enormous amount of money into K-12, and we'd never achieve the results that Oregonians deserve because some children wouldn't be ready to learn when they got there. So understanding how the early learning hubs play a role in providing these foundational connections, this opportunity for brain growth, this opportunity for social emotional development, this opportunity for all the pre-literacy work that has to happen to make kids ready to learn to read by the time they hit kindergarten, to make sure that developmental issues are identified and addressed at the earliest stage possible, because we know that so many of these things can be dealt with very, very successfully as long as we intervene early. I say this more often than you guys probably care to hear, but there's a reason that the adage, a stitch in time saves nine, has been around for so long, and that's because we know that dealing with a problem very, very early is much more successful and much easier than waiting until it becomes a big problem. And when we wait until kindergarten to address issues for kids, that means we're doing those 9 stitches when we could have done 1 if we dealt with it when they were a year old. So as we think about this stuff, we have to be thinking about how do we develop 2-generational approaches? How do we coach parents who are struggling with parenting to be great parents? Because everyone wants to be a great parent. Some people just don't have the background to be empowered to be a great parent. And we know that great parents help create great kids, kids who are ready to learn. We know that kids who have families that support their intellectual, their emotional growth, their social growth, those families do better as a whole, and those kids do better. And the early learning hubs are doing a great job of promoting this multidisciplinary approach, making sure that families at most need have exactly the right services, so we're neither spending too much nor too little time, money, and effort on these families at need. They're very precisely targeting the things that each individual family or child needs. They're thinking about them in a very holistic, systematic way rather than breaking down rather than siloing things out and saying, well, you have to go over here to get these safety net services and over there to get these developmental tools and over there to get your health care. While they're not providing direct health care or these direct services, they're really doing a great job coordinating for families. And working with families in this way is what's going to set up this next generation of Oregonians, our youngest, most vulnerable Oregonians, for success down the road. It's what's going to make sure that 20 years from now, our prison population has dropped precipitously, because we know that coming into school ready to learn at kindergarten is a direct predictor of your likelihood of interacting with the criminal justice system. We know that the unemployment rate is directly related to whether kids have the skills they need to be productive members of our workforce. So as we look toward helping Oregon have a sustainable future in the broadest sense of that term, the early learning hubs play a critical role, and I urge your support for Senate Bill 213. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions for Senator Steiner Hayward about this bill?
About this bill, absolutely. This bill. A gazillion. How many zeros are in a gazillion?
An awful lot,
about
Senator.
This bill.
An awful lot. But fortunately, we don't have to talk about that number because you understood why I used it. Sorry, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the answer is an awful lot.
An awful lot.
Any Thank further you. Questions for Senator Steiner Hayward
about
this bill? I know we all have many questions for you about many things.
Yeah, all right. I'm afraid of that. Madam Chair, thank you for your consideration in allowing me to testify early on this. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. So I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 213, but we will open it back up. And I'm going to open up the bills for which nobody has signed up. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 40. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 40 extends the tax credit for child with disability as a subsequent referral to tax credits, and I know that Mr. Alanak from Legislative Fiscal Office is available to answer questions. The background that's on the staff measure summary that's on OLIS and available to the members is lifted directly from the legislative research report that he prepared that analyzes all the credits related to the elderly and the disabled together. So the language is straight from that report.
And I do believe there is testimony in OLIS from Leslie Sutton of the Council on Developmental Disabilities.
Yes.
Do people have questions? Do you want Paul to come up, or do you want to follow up on your own later?
Well, it's nice to just have a brief. How
sure.
do you like doing that? Just a brief.
Do you mind coming up for a minute, Chris?
Or have you done this? Was that the meeting I missed?
No.
Okay.
These are they've had a much more lengthy hearing on each of these on the House side. So all of the tax credit bills, identical bills, were introduced in the House and in the Senate.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. Senate Bill 40 is the tax credit for a child with a disability. And part of the core structure of the income tax system is that every taxpayer is allowed a personal exemption credit. Right now it's worth about $190. A child with a disability is just an additional personal exemption credit. So the value of the credit is $190 currently, and it is indexed to inflation. It's a pretty straightforward tax credit.
Any questions?
I think it's an important tax credit.
All right, then. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 40? Why don't you stay right there, Chris?
Okay.
Seeing that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 43.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 43 also has a referral to tax credits, is another tax credit review bill. It extends the additional personal exemption credit for severe disability to 2022.
Chris.
Madam Chair. Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. Again, it's the personal exemption credit. The severe statute defines severe disability as any of the following: the loss of use of one or more lower extremities, the loss of use of both hands, or permanent blindness. And then there's a physical or mental condition that limits the abilities of the person to earn a living, maintain a household, and provide personal transportation without employing special orthopedic or medical equipment or outside help. So it's, again, a pretty straightforward tax credit.
Any questions?
And again, another important tax credit.
Chris, would this tax credit apply to 100% disabled veterans?
It should.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 43? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 43 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 48.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 48 has a subsequent referral to tax credits. It's the one that extends the credit for employer-provided dependent care assistance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this credit is for employers. There are, within the context of the tax credits that are under sunset review this time, there are four related to child care. There are two consumer child care credits, one provider-related child care credit, and one for the employers. This is the employer tax credit, and it is 50% of the eligible costs paid up to $2,500 per employee, or 50% of the cost of providing referral services. So there can be the payment for the referral services for the employee, or it can be just an outlay for helping provide, help pay for child care. About 12 corporations claim it, and about 75 personal income tax payers claim it. It does require certification by the Office of Child Care. And I'm not sure how much more detail.
And how much do we spend on it per biennium?
It is about $1 million a year.
So about $2 million a biennium?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you have, I didn't bring that your tax credit report. Did you have any modifications, suggestions in your summary at all?
Not in, well, let's see. A potential variation in the value of the credit if there's some sort of quality of child care. So a larger credit for child care providers that meet certain criteria that are higher quality providers. Oh. Something like that. Perhaps a focus on on-site child care or a couple of the possible ideas. I don't know what people think of those.
Do you know, did they make any modifications on the House side?
It is still in the House Business and Labor Committee.
Oh, so this one didn't go to Human Services on the other side?
It did, and it's gone back and forth between Human Services and Business and Labor.
Okay.
And there's been some question about whether or not all of the child care tax credits should have been put together or not.
Okay.
But Business and Labor is still debating this one.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Any further questions for Chris? And the one person I have signed up for this one is Jody Weiser.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, representing Tax Fairness Oregon. It's nice to have the opportunity to speak with you today. This credit is $2,500 per child, which is a nice hunk of money if you have a large organization and you have a lot of kids or adults that are dependents of your employees getting care. And our concern is that we have underfunded programs for low-income children and child care, and this is probably reaching a lot of higher income people. Is being used as an inducement for, you know, providing lots of benefits at businesses rather than really reaching the parents who are struggling to pay for child care. And so while it makes sense to take your kid to work with you and have child care there, or to use basically, it's kind of like a health savings account, a child care savings account, so that you shelter your income from taxes and pay for child care, and your employer does that with you. It's the kind of thing that is a benefit for wealthier employees rather than needier employees. And probably it's an inducement, just like having free lunches or a tennis court at the job site is an inducement. And we don't really have the funds to be doing that sort of benefits. Thank you.
Thank you.
Marcia Kelly from the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I'm standing in for the much more articulate John Mullen, who's the co-chair of the HISCO Tax and Revenue Committee. The HISCO Tax and Revenue Committee is supporting the family child care, the child care assistance, and the IDEA tax credits, and just reminding the committees that the co-chairs, I believe, have allowed $16 million in tax credits, and there are $64 million being asked for. So we're asking you to look at all tax credits very carefully. This would be one that I would consider maybe looking at with really fine-tuning. I had a hard time finding companies that really advertised that they had child care available. I think I came up with three or four at the beginning of the session when I was trying to search for everything. There doesn't seem to be an organized group of people who work on this together. I believe that Nike has it, but I couldn't find anything for sure. I believe that Intel probably does, but nothing. Fred Meyer buys some, and the hospital in the Dalles, I believe, has a child care center. But it's really hard to come up with information on how it's being used just out in the general public. So I would think that this is not available to the general run-of-the-mill mother who's looking for child care.
Or father.
Or father.
Yes, I should be careful about that. But I have women in my name this year.
Very good. Any further questions for this panel? No? Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 48? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill. So we're going to excuse you for a minute. We're jumping away from taxes.
Tax credit.
We're going to go to Social Security. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 710.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 710 requires specified entities to provide one free copy of identifiable health information upon request, hard copy or digital, for the purpose of application or appeal of Social Security disability benefits. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and a fiscal statement issued. It's available on OLIS, and we put hard copies at the dais for everyone to look at. It's a minimal impact on the Oregon Health Authority, and costs relating to the bill for OHSU would not directly provided by state funding.
Great. So we have four people signed up for this bill. If you could all come up at once, that would be great. Melissa Haggerty, Cynthia Foster, Max Rowe, and Linda
Lunsden.
And there's also testimony online in OLIS from several parties. Welcome.
Hi there. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Melissa Haggerty, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself and Cheryl Kuhn as well. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about 710. It would assist Oregon's most vulnerable populations as they're seeking to get disability benefits, as was noted. The most important piece of a Social Security disability claim is the medical record. And this evidence for most Oregonians can be difficult to get at the hearing stage. And I'll explain, because when an Oregonian applies for disability benefits, at first they provide the names of every facility they've been to. And it's Social Security's obligation to get the medical evidence at the first two stages. But if they don't win at those first two stages, which most don't, they go to a hearing. And at that point, it's their obligation. Unfortunately, Social Security doesn't follow their follow up and update those records, which means there can be 2 years of records that's the obligation of the applicant to update. And unfortunately, this can be very costly. And for most folks, we see it costs between $200 and $700 to update the records from all the facilities that they've been seen at over those 2 years in the interim. And this is a serious burden, because these are people who have been out of work. They're folks who don't have the resources to be spending money at these different facilities. And it's just a big financial barrier that could be removed by Senate Bill 710. 18 states have already passed similar laws, and we are actually lagging behind Kentucky, Louisiana, Tennessee, Texas, and West Virginia when it comes to helping folks with disabilities get medical records at an affordable price. As was noted, there's not a financial burden on the state of Oregon, and actually we believe it would ameliorate some of the cost to the state of Oregon, because folks who are on benefits are going to have less of a need for other state support. So thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of 710.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Foster, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 710. In 2012, after my career as an RN, I found myself unable to continue working and applied for my Social Security benefits. The cost of my medical records was close to $200. Although I had been employed in the past, my resources were very limited, and it was quite a hardship to pay for that. I won my case, but without my records, I would not have. I don't think anyone should be unable to pursue a disability claim because they can't afford to pay for medical records that would serve as evidence in their case. I urge you to support Senate Bill 710. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Linda Lumsden. I live in Eugene, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 710. My foster son, at the age of 26, in April of 2010, applied for Social Security benefits. At that point, he was residing in California. He had been in state care since the age of three. He was born, exposed to drugs and alcohol prenatally, then experienced extreme physical and sexual abuse, and was removed by child welfare in Oregon from his biological home at the age of three. So he was in state care from the age of three on up till aging out of foster care. He came to live with me at the age of 11. And I provided long-term care for him. And they had run out of resources in his home county for placements for him in Josephine County at that point. So he made remarkable gains while he was in foster care during the years he was with me. But ultimately, even though he wanted to be self-supporting, he was not able to maintain jobs over time, and he held approximately 40 jobs by the time he was 26 because he could not sustain them over time. And so at the age of 26, I helped him to apply for SSI benefits, and fortunately, he was living in California, where there is already legislation similar to that, to the bill that you're considering today for Oregon, where applicants are entitled to one free copy of their medical records if they reside in California. So we did not have any financial issues regarding obtaining his medical records that would serve as critical evidence in his case. And his case was pending for approximately 5 years as it went through appeals, his original hearing. He received a denial and then ultimately was approved this past year and started receiving benefits this last month. And so he will have some source of, you know, modest ongoing stable income over time. But applying for disability is an arduous, complicated process with a lot of forms to be filled out, you know, records to be provided, timelines to be met, often additional evaluations to be performed. And the financial barrier is just one more barrier for folks, especially if they have any deficits that get in the way, like he has some cognitive deficits and multiple mental health issues. And it's a very challenging process. Actually, while his claim was pending, I was diagnosed with a blood cancer that is treatable but not ultimately curable, and was given a 5-year life expectancy. So fortunately, I'm still here. Well, you know, when his claim ultimately was won, but I think there are many individuals that are similar to Jason that are, whether they're aging out of the foster care system or just other populations that have diagnoses, but they don't have anyone in their life to kind of shepherd them through the process and cover any financial expenses that may be related to pursuing a claim or the appeal of a claim. And
thank you so much for coming to tell the story and explaining why it's so important to be able to access the benefits and the barrier that that cost provides.
Yes.
I'm glad you were able to help your son get through that process.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Max Ray. I'm an attorney in private practice, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I brought two invoices just briefly to show you how this works in practice. I brought a $36 invoice that I received for 12 pages of records. I didn't actually get records. What I got was an email link to download those records, $36. The second invoice was $110. That was a compact disc that was mailed to me. The records were on the disc. Electronic records, they could have put 3,000 pages of records on that disc, and it wouldn't have cost them any more, any less. This is a significant financial burden for folks, and as healthcare providers become more electronic, and many of them are becoming more electronic, the actual burden of providing records, it isn't like someone has to stand at a copy machine and make them. It's actually quite doable and quite reasonable to ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this? Hey, committee. Are there any questions for this panel?
No. Not for this panel. No, thanks.
Hey, committee, what's going on over here?
We're committeeing.
Yeah, well, we're having a committee meeting here.
Sorry.
It's relevant. We'll talk about it.
Is OHA going to, not OHA, but who would be the entity where these requests, someone from Social Security, someone coming? I just wanted to know how many applicants per year are being requested from various providers. I guess that's what I wanted to know.
In an average case going to hearing, I will probably have 4 to 6 medical requests to different facilities. It really depends how many specialists a person has seen, how many different emergency rooms that they've been to, but 4 to 6 in my practice is a pretty typical update.
And so you would have to go, the request for medical records could be the hospital, could be the clinic, could be a physician, and you would need to have all of those? Is that what is required?
You know, it's a problematic situation. The Social Security Administration's rules absolutely require that they do these updates. They act in contempt of their rules. And if your clients are going to have a fair opportunity to present their case, the attorney or representative or the person is going to have to go get those rules because the agency is indifferent to their responsibility.
But they have to go to all of the providers that individual has seen in that period of time?
You know, if they went to a dentist, I would probably skip that. If they were seen at an urgent care clinic for an acute sinus infection, I would probably skip that. But anything that has a substantive impact upon the problems that interfere with regular work attendance, yes, I would need to go get that.
Any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 710?
No one else has signed up?
No.
Because, if we pass legislation, it sure would be nice to hear from an agency that this is going to impact. Do they get 50,000 requests?
So I think it's because it doesn't impact a particular agency. The issue is the individual goes, they make their application for Social Security benefits. It's a matter of pulling together all of their medical records to turn into Social Security. So it's the hospital, the physician, and the attorney. The person that's requesting the records is the attorney for the individual or the individual themselves.
But the insurance plans, do they provide it, or is it just hospitals and providers?
Could the two attorneys come back up who do this? Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Because I know, it could be a burden on a provider. I don't know how many requests for records. It isn't just for Social Security benefits, but, it'd be interesting to see.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, for each claimant, there could be, like Mr. Ray said, anywhere between 4 or, say, 20. These records are already being requested. It's just a matter of how much are we paying for them to provide typically now digital records. So the work is already being performed. It's a simple matter of how much are we paying the claimant paying ultimately, because the lawyers aren't allowed to front that cost. It actually goes to the claimant themselves. And it can vary, as Mr. Ray demonstrated, between $30 and $150 per facility. And I can't assess for you the total cost.
All right. So the good staff to my left here just said, like, for the Oregon Health Sciences University, it estimates that the fiscal impact of this bill to range from $100,000 to $120,000 per biennium. The impact is entirely driven by the requirement that authorized representatives be provided a free copy of records. Currently, though, OHSU does not deny a patient or the patient's personal representative a request for information due to financial hardship. So I'm just wondering if the bill is necessary, if most of the providers provide it for free for financial.
Let me clarify, Chair Gelser, Senator Anderson. OHSU is not required to provide for free to their patients. That's something they do. That is something they choose to do. What's really important to note is that the people that need this service the most, the people who have cognitive impairments, mental health impairments, they aren't really the folks who are going to have the capacity to go to their provider and say, hey, I need all my records, all my lab results, every MRI I've ever had, and I need to then get that into Social Security. Those are the folks who need an attorney or a representative to do that for them and to coordinate getting records from 10 facilities. And to expect someone who is unable to work, doesn't have the capacity to even hold a simple job, to then go navigate the bureaucracy of each individual provider is just too much of a burden. And to clarify, not every facility will provide for free. Some do a reduced cost for their own patients, but it's not obligated. So I hope that answered the question, Chair and Senator.
Many providers, the big ones, Kaiser, some of the hospitals, will have a patient portal. And you can get a code number, you can log in, and you can see your file. The file that you see is an abbreviated copy. It very seldom contains the kind of detailed chart recording that the doctors actually prepare to guarantee continuity of care. And so downloading the free stuff through the patient portal isn't going to meet the need.
Are there other questions?
Yeah, I have one, though. Thank you.
Sarah Olson.
If an attorney goes in to collect the data, does the attorney bill the patient?
Senator Gelser, Senator Olson, yes, we aren't allowed, under our ethics rules, we aren't allowed to front the cost of the hearing. So every single cost I receive, every bill from OHSU through DBS, that is passed on to the patient, to the claimant. It is their responsibility ultimately. So when a case is done, most of my clients owe $200 or $300 in outstanding medical evidence costs.
And can you say your name for the record?
Melissa Haggerty, I apologize.
And is that the case even if you're representing somebody pro bono? So you have an incredibly poor person that comes in that has no income, that's struggling with a mental illness, that may have no family supports. Can you front that money for them, or do they still need to pay that?
Chair Gelser, the way it's structured, we get paid only if we win. And so it's always a contingent fee. So those who are low income, which most of our clients are, have the same costs as someone who does have a lot of money in the bank.
But at the beginning, though,
right,
they would have to pay to get the records to come before you can make the application.
We typically, in order to make the record complete, we have to pay it, and then it's their obligation. They owe us.
Which brings me to another question.
Yes.
That you started to get into, but you didn't go far enough. If you win the case, I mean, do you charge them for the time you go over to get the records?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, at least in our office, and I believe this would be a best practice, they pay only for the actual cost that's invoiced. So the two invoices on your desk, that $136, that's what they pay. There's no additional add-on TAC fee that I put in an administrative service fee or anything like that. I would presume that's best practice. I know that's what I do in my office.
The fees in Social Security cases are generally a contingent fee, quarter of past due benefits up to a cap. The current cap is $6,000. And that includes all labor that's expended in developing the case. So to say we don't charge for it is sort of a misnomer. We don't charge extra for it, but it's part of the overall overall labor in presenting the case.
Either one then. So you said the cap was $6,000.
It currently is.
That's as high as you can go with your attorney's fees.
Well,
if you win only.
You know, with the Social Security Administration rules, the more questions you ask, the more complicated it gets. The standard fee agreement is a cap of $6,000. Now, that amount is set by the agency, and they can change it. A person is free to have a per-hour contract or is free to take up to a quarter of benefits withheld and apply a computation of their hours. That's available. I don't do it, and I don't know of anyone else that does it at the first level because it's such a bureaucratic headache. The standard fee agreement that just about everybody uses is a quarter of the past up to a 6,000 cap, and then that's processed without that extra paperwork at the end.
Follow up? Is there a income threshold, like somebody with a $250,000 income can come to you and say, I want to declare a Social Security disability and I want you to get this for me?
No. Social Security is based upon the money that has been taken out of that person's earnings over the years. It's like social insurance. They have paid in, and if they qualify as disabled, they're entitled to collect that insurance back. Just like when the millionaire's house burns down and he's paid for the fire insurance, he can collect on that coverage.
Follow up. So then someone that makes a quarter of a million on up or $100,000 on up would get free records also?
Cheryl Gelsler, Senator Olson, you're correct. I will say that the bulk of the people that I represent, and I would assume the same for Mr. Ray, they're not looking at SSD. They're primarily looking at SSI, and these are folks who have less than $2,000 in assets. That is the categorical limit. So the bulk of the people seeking disability benefits aren't the folks with $1 million in the bank because they can pay for it themselves. They're the folks who really have no other option and are fighting to get $733 a month in sort of subsistence support.
My clients are somewhat better off. Mostly they're working people. But working people, when they're no longer able to work, run thin on funds pretty quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? And then thank you both very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 710? Nope, seeing none. So we have all the paperwork, but I think people have some more questions. So I'm going to hold this over, but I am... Cheyenne, can we repost this for next Tuesday, for a work session on Tuesday, please? Thank you. So we'll hold over the work session until Tuesday.
Chair, it would be nice. I mean, the hospitals, particularly the hospitals, didn't, because they get,
or maybe the providers, like OMA, you know, it would be nice to know if the providers have a position on this.
It's been posted for a couple weeks.
I know, but sometimes we just have to go right out and say, get in, get here.
All right. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on, was that an O? Can I close the public hearing?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 710. And then we have Senator Knope, so I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 729.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as soon as I find the summary for 729.
Yes.
This creates a personal income tax credit for adoption of children of foster care of $5,000 per child. It applies starting with the 2015 tax year and takes effect the 91st day after signee died. It has a subsequent referral to tax credits also.
Welcome, Senator Knope.
Thank you. So I hate to disappoint you, and I do love that tax credit too, but I'm actually here for Senate Bill 760, which is the food crop.
All right. Well, please hold. Is there anybody? You were the only person signed up for Senate Bill 729. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 729? No? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 729. You know what? We had an email from Senator Boquist that said he could not be here. But he likes this very much. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 729 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 760.
Madam Chair, Senator Knope, my apologies. That is my getting the bills confused and writing your name in incorrectly on the witness
sheet,
sir. Senate Bill 760, with its referral to tax credit, increases the percentage of wholesale price of donated crops allowed as the amount of the tax credit from currently at 15% to 50%. It applies starting the 2015 tax year. Takes effect the 91st day after signing down.
Senator Knope, would you like to talk about
crops?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. State Senator Tim Canope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Sun River, and Tumalo, and rural areas surrounding. Senate Bill 760 is Senator Ferriola's bill regarding food tax credits for crop donations. And we all know that in Oregon, we are a hungry state. And despite Fruit Fridays here or Waffle Wednesdays, which are awesome, and we just had a great food drive, we are still a hungry state. And so what we are trying to do is find a way to feed Oregonians. And this bill is really simple, and it simply raises from 15% to 50% the tax credit for the value of the wholesale price of a crop. And this is going to increase the amount of fresh and nutritious vegetables and fruit available to vulnerable families in need of food assistance. The bill expands the credit and will increase the amount of food donated to food banks or charitable organizations that distribute food to children, the homeless, unemployed, elderly, and low-income individuals. I think this tax credit is mutually beneficial to the poor who need the food and to the farmers who have excess food. It does cost the farmer. We have a real live farmer in the Senate who could probably speak to this, but it does cost to prepare and transport, package food that goes to the food banks. And I know my food bank does a great job, but they can always use more. And we can't rely on Senator Hansel to come up with a truckload of potatoes every time we need them. And so we want to expand, we want to really expand this credit out and encourage our farmers to the degree possible to donate their excess food. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions on this bill.
Are there any questions for Senator Canope?
I have one. Senator Canope, thank you.
What's up?
Well, I would suggest, and I agree with this, because if a farmer produces a crop that's valued at $100, it takes a quantity of money to generate that $100 crop. And if they only get a $10 credit on it, it really behooves them, which is cheaper, to throw the crop away or to donate it. I would like to make it where they really feel that this is good for business to give this food to the food bank and not destroy it.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, that's exactly where we're trying to get, is because there obviously is a cost, and we want to try to make it so that the farmer will want to participate more in the program, because I think that ultimately the more food that we can put into the food banks to feed people, the better off Oregon is going to be. And I think it, quite frankly, is the most effective way to do that. We obviously have programs for, SNAP and the different types of programs that are out there. But we all know people in our communities who are very food poor. They may be our neighbors, our kids at school and so on, who may not be eating on the weekend, that type of thing. And so I just think this is a worthy policy objective, and would encourage it to send it on down to Revenue or Ways and Means to see if we can't get it funded.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, I'd just say, for most farmers in a good year, operated on about a 4% margin, so something like this would be very helpful to encourage them to do, because Senator Canope's right. When you're running at a thin margin like that, sometimes the cheapest thing to do is leave it in the field. And so if there is an incentive to not do that, I think that would be very helpful.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So first of all, a 50% jump from 15% seems pretty dramatic. And I'm wondering if you've heard, do we have evidence that the program today is not working as well as it could, that, that there are you hearing from many people that they would do this, they would contribute more to the food bank if that credit were just a little higher?
Chair Gelser and Senator Dimbrough, I think that is in fact the case, is that I know Senator Ferriola put this bill in because I know he had heard from constituents that said, hey, you know, we'd love to do this, but it probably is more cost effective for us, even though we want to do this. We can't even sometimes afford to do it and to take the food over there. And so increasing this, I think, would be a benefit to that. And I think it would encourage more farmers to do it. I think it would make them think twice about leaving it in the field. And, I mean, when we have hungry Oregonians, and we tend to be on the, well, the high end of food insecure and those types of things. So I think it would be a benefit. I agree with you. I think it's a significant jump and would certainly get a lot of people's attention. And obviously it's the legislature's decision on where to, you know, put that number in terms of the percentage. But I think raising it significantly will get a more significant participation, which I think would benefit the state.
If I could just follow up. I mean, we're struggling now to find money to fund schools, and obviously everything that goes to a tax credit is money that can't go to schools. And, you know, I'm just, if the need is clear and strong, then I think we need to look at it. But if there's not a really clear, pressing need, I think I'd rather have the dollars go to schools.
Chair Gelser, Senator Embrough, while I agree that schools are very important, I think we got to feed them first, you know, and we want to send them to school ready to learn. I think that's important as well. And I don't think we're talking about millions and millions of dollars here.
No.
I mean, I think we're talking about a pretty low investment for, I think, a pretty great return. So what I really want us to do is just look at this as a policy and see if it doesn't make sense to increase that percentage rate and try to get more farmers that to participate, because I think we'll be pleasantly surprised with the result.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
From personal experience, I live around a truck farmer, and I have many times seen cucumbers and green beans and turnips. Well, turnips didn't bother me that much, but plowed under because it was cheaper to plow them under and turn them over than it was to pick them. Now, if they could pick them and get a value to them that wouldn't go to the market but would go to the food bank, I would suggest that that's a great opportunity to get those vegetables into the food bank. The other thing is, too, is, you know, we have lunch programs and breakfast programs for our children. We obviously realize that they need to eat, and they need to eat healthy. And I think this would be a good investment. Perhaps we look at what the number is, but...
Senator Olson, next week we're going to make turnip waffles for Waffle Wednesday.
We'll pass.
And those will be just free.
I can bring turnips in. I get plenty out there.
Are there any further questions or comments for Senator Knope?
Not for Senator Knope, but for Chris. And
Chris, do you want to come back up?
I would like to know, at the 15% value, how much... Do you have that information regarding how many take advantage of the 15%?
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue. The 15% has just been in place for this year.
Oh.
Prior it was 10%, and it sunset at the end of 2011, so there was no credit for 2012 and 2013. And then in the 2014 session, it was recreated at 15%. So we're expecting an annual impact at the 15% of $200,000 or $250,000 a year. So if a 15% credit goes up to 50%, that's three times the credit. So just off the top of my head, the simple arithmetic puts the revenue impact at $700,000 a year.
Thank you very much.
And I think I recall when we had this on the floor last session, at least in the House, we had a pretty vigorous debate about whether or not it was enough and whether we could do more. And we talked about coming back in the session to talk about doing more.
If I can add, Chris, I know you probably don't know this, but you know everything that goes around in this building. Do you know the quantity of food? When they report, do they report the quantity of food they've given?
I do know that I have gotten some of that, at least some of that information is available from the food bank. I don't have any numbers off the top of my head, but I know it's available, and I've gotten some of that from the food bank. I don't know if they have any information at the ready, but it is available to get.
Thank you.
Pardon? Okay. Yeah, we've got them coming. So, thank you both very much.
Thank
All right,
you.
Next we have Katie Fast, Molly McCarger, and Philip Kennedy Wong. Will you take over from
Sure.
Thanks. Last time I left, you killed the bills.
Come on, kid.
You know, I have a question while we're waiting. For instance, my church, we have a huge community garden, and we give hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of beans, potatoes, tomatoes, lots of food to the food bank. And I'm wondering if the church, we donate at all. And I was just wondering if they could get a tax credit from a nonprofit.
Well, they don't really pay taxes, do they?
You're probably right. I was just curious, from nonprofits, if nonprofits have a community garden, would they...
If you don't pay taxes, a tax credit wouldn't be a lot of good, I wouldn't think.
Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau is in support of Senate Bill 760. The crop donation tax credit, as you've heard, is allowed against personal and corporate income taxes when farmers donate crops to a food bank or entities that distribute food, other nonprofits. The tax credit's purpose is to help offset production costs incurred in the growing, harvesting, and transporting of these crops, and you actually have an expert here on the panel that can talk to that more. The current rate is at 15% of the wholesale price, and 760 increases that to 50%, which is the rate in the 2013 tax expenditure report that the Department of Agriculture actually recommends that this tax credit be set at. And I think that is important because that is the rate that they see that would offset the costs for labor, for land prices, for the transportation and harvesting costs that farmers incur on getting these crops to the food banks, and that the Department of Agriculture would actually see that, you know, we would see that exponential growth in crops donated to local food banks and across the state. Farm Bureau requests that this committee just sends this bill on to the tax credit committee, where the discussion around what's the appropriate rate can be discussed in what fits into this budget cycle. So thank you.
Committee, for the record, my name is Molly McCarger. I'm a fourth generation farmer just north of Salem here in the Jervis area. And I live in a school district of 85% students that are free and reduced. And so we see hunger. I'm on the school board, and so I'm very well aware of its impacts in our kids. But also, I'm a former educator, returned to the family farm. And so I feel like I'm pretty versed in this, especially since in 2014, just this last year, our farm donated approximately 110,000 pounds of fruits and vegetables. 76,000 pounds of it went to the Marion Polk Food Share here in Salem, and then roughly 35,000 pounds we set aside specifically for farmers ending hunger, and it's vegetables that we grow for NORPAC. And so we had an acre of green beans and an acre of corn that they process, and then through Farmers Ending Hunger, it gets to the Oregon Food Bank. And I can tell you exactly how much it costs to grow something per acre, and we do everything per acre, and I usually do things in tons, but pounds sound more effective and like they're bigger numbers, so I'll use pounds when trying to impress you. Corn we make no money on a good year we might net $50 after overhead. Broccoli is one of our better producers, and we may net anywhere from $500 to $750 an acre. Land values are $16,000 an acre right now, so if I were to buy a farm and was going to grow broccoli, you probably wouldn't loan me money to buy that farm. Oh. So when it costs us $2,000 to $2,500 an acre to grow broccoli, and we're getting paid approximately $2,750, it's hit and miss. In 2014, it was kind of a good year. 2013, it was a terrible year. Oh. So we never know. A 15% income or a 15% credit would roughly give us, if I was doing all my math right quickly back there, it would be about a $400 an acre payback on what we donated this last year. So if it costs us $2,000 to $2,500 an acre to grow, and we receive maybe $400 an acre, but this is based on estimated income. And so there's lots of numbers, and it'll vary from farm to farm. But basically, it doesn't cover the labor to harvest. It costs us about $500 to $600 an acre to harvest broccoli, just for the labor alone. That doesn't include our tractors. It doesn't include trucks and everything else that goes along with it. That's so to raise it to 50%, you're going to have a lot more farmers inclined to donate if they know they can at least get half their costs covered, and labor being one of them. Labor is very hard to come by these days, and it's a battle. And so that makes it even less enticing. But if there's a reason, I mean, if they have some sort of incentive, they'll do it. We left about 1.5 million pounds of cauliflower in the field this last year. We had 12 acres left unharvested because we met our contract. And it was difficult to find a home for the remaining. So, you want it?
Yeah,
all right,
come get
all right.
Some.
Sign up with Salem Harvest, yeah. And they will they'll let you know. And so we've been working with groups like Salem Harvest in the area, and they have volunteers that come out and will harvest what's left. And half of it, the volunteers get to keep half of what they harvest, and the other half will go to the food banks. Marion Polk Food Share is usually the recipient, but when it's volume size so great that they can't handle it just in the network here, then they will call the Oregon Food Bank and will help get it distributed to other regional banks throughout the state if possible. So there's lots of – I can give you all sorts of numbers.
I think we have to start moving along a little bit because we have lots of people on the next bill.
So it's bottom line, very important, I think.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong, here representing Oregon Food Bank. We appreciate the continuing of this very, very important conversation of, you know, addressing hunger in the state of Oregon. You know, Senate Bill 760 does that, and we certainly do hope this committee passes it on to the Joint Tax Credit Committee to have further discussion. I will start just to paint more of a picture of some of the things that we are starting to explore. So for a food bank perspective, you know, there are three primary sources of food that we get. And they start with grocers, so the retail side, secondarily food processors, and then finally growers. And it's in the part of the growing, you know, as far as the grower side, where we believe where there's a lot of opportunity to really not just you know, get more healthier food for Oregonians that are, you know, experiencing food insecurity, but also to help bolster our agricultural community. So I was at a meeting recently with Marion Polk Food Share, and we were talking to one of those groups that Molly had mentioned, and it became very stark to me when they explained that, you know, farmers, they typically have to plant more than what they're contracted for because they have to, you know, build in some room for error or room for, well, you know, Mother Nature, things like that. I mean, whether it's like, you know, storm damage or, you know, what have you, it makes it very difficult. And or they may grow something that doesn't meet, you know, the what's called, you know, first grade or first quality. But there's still, you know, sunken cost to that. But the food is also still edible. And we do know just from our conversations with farmers across the state that, you know, the tax credit that was passed in 2014, you know, we are hearing a lot of farmers are excited about the tax credit getting reinstated. So we are in the process of collecting information, and hopefully we can learn a lot about what are some of the challenges that farmers face in getting food out of the field and into, you know, people's tables. And lastly, I will say one of the beauty of the crop donation program is food that, say, Marion Polk Food Share is unable to use, they could feed other Oregonians in different parts of the state. So it's, you know, community supporting community. So I'll leave my comments at this and be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And Katie, did you already speak while I was having?
Yeah.
Great. Are there any questions from the
just to expand it a little bit, it's not just the farmers who have cannery contracts. It's also the farmers who are doing fresh market, because you're always going to have more than you need at the beginning, and then you hit the peak and at the end. And basically what we're looking at is the ability to recover harvest cost, which is an incentive to actually get it done.
Thank you all very much. And then, Jody, can you come and be relatively brief? Please, thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I'll be quick. I think we have the opportunity to actually get some statistics. We had years when we had a 10% credit. We had a year when, or two, when we had no credit. And now we've had a year with 15% credit. And so we should be able to track the donations and see how the credit affects things rather than just jumping on the idea that we should increase it. And you have written testimony that David prepared. What if you look in the graph part, the chart portion of it, this is from statistics from the USDA, and it shows the average gross sales per acre, the average net income per acre, what the tax credit would be, which is about the same as the normal net income in Oregon, and that a 50% tax credit would actually give you more profit than is typical for a farmer to make. Now, these are averages, and you're right. You have crops. You know, I'm a fourth generation farmer as well, and you have crops where year after year you make almost nothing, but you pay the rent, and you're buying that land, or you've signed a lease agreement with the land. And you have crops where you consistently make $500, $600 an acre, and sometimes $1,000 an acre. And you have that full range of crops when you're a farmer. And so these statistics don't really reflect that. But 50% of the wholesale price is a darn good thing, since you're also getting to deduct the cost of growing the crops as part of your taxes. And so it looks like it's a little too generous, and I think we should look at the statistics that we can gather for what our percentages have done and then make a decision rather than acting now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 760? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 760. And I'm going to throw the gavel around. And before I open Senate Bill 213, I just have to note I'm having a little bit of a flashback Thursday of my own here. The very first time I ever came to the legislature, Judy Newman brought me here to talk to Barbara Ross, and they're both sitting in the back of the room. And my children were much smaller then. So thank you both for really being good mentors for a lot of families and people. So I'm going to reopen Senate Bill 213. So, Lindsay, I have you signed up separate from everybody else not on a panel. Do you want to come by yourself? All right. So how about Lindsay Capps, Pam Curtis, and Megan Irwin? Welcome, and thank you for being patient.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm Lindsay Capps, the Education and Early Learning Policy Advisor to Governor Kate Brown. I'm very proud and pleased to be here today to offer the governor's strong support for Senate Bill 213 and Oregon's regional and community-based early learning hubs. Governor Brown has made clear that early learning is a top priority for her. Supporting young children and their families is truly the foundation for ensuring that each and every Oregon child meets their full potential and therefore the long-term economic prosperity of our state. I think we all know the context of this conversation. We have an early learning system that has not fully formed and become systematized. The supports and services that are available still do not reach a fraction of the children and families who need these supports and services. And we know too much now about brain development and the amount of learning and growth that happens between ages 0 through 5, so that we know that doing everything we can once children reach kindergarten and through K-12 is not enough. It's not an adequate strategy if we're serious about improving educational attainment and closing the opportunity gap for all students in this state. The governor recognizes we have to invest early in systems and structures that can support the health, learning, and development of children from birth. And the early learning hubs we see as the local coordinators and catalysts of the supports and services to do that. And they are creating the systems through which we can ensure that the supports and services are reaching underserved 0 through 5 year olds and their families. We need these hubs to ensure every child enters kindergarten ready to learn. And the governor urges your support for Senate Bill 215 and hopes for its passage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Pam Curtis. I am the director at the Center for Evidence-Based Policy based at Oregon Health and Science University, and I have the fortune and honor to chair the Early Learning Council. I was going to say a lot of what Senator Steiner Hayward said, so I'll just say ditto. And then what I really want to do then is to provide you with some context about the creation of the Early Learning Hubs. So in 2011, the legislature passed Senate Bill 909, which created the Early Learning Council and charged the council with formulating recommendations to merge and redesign and improve early learning services for our state. We were charged with coordinating and aligning those services so that they focused on child and family-centered outcomes. The recommendations and your charge to us included bringing together state programs under one umbrella, which turned out to be the Early Learning Division, and Megan Irwin is here to talk to that. But we also knew that coordinating at the state level was not going to be enough. So I want to read to you from the report that was submitted in 2011 recommending the creation of the early learning system. So I read, in order to redesign and integrate existing early childhood services into a coordinated and high-functioning early learning and education system, adaptive change across multiple sectors will be required. Oregon needs to transform our collection of early childhood programs from a focus on programs and structural perpetuity to one of direct service delivery and a focus on achieving real results for children. This transformation will require change, management, and organizational support throughout the implementation process. Those who work in early learning in our state are committed to the well-being of children and families, but a change in the system will require change by people. To be successful, people must be able to envision a change in their own work. They must be able to think outside of the framework of their current organization, and they must be supported throughout the change process. Moreover, a broader view of early learning is required, one that encompasses more than narrowly defined traditional preschool environments, but rather includes all settings where children are or should be well served, from child care to health and human services. So as this report alluded, in order for coordination and alignment to lead to transformation, it has to happen on the ground, and it has to be driven by people. People who can put children and families at the center of their work and have a vision for the possible. It's this belief that led to the creation of the Early Learning Hubs, which is the subject of the bill in front of you. While Early Learning Hubs are overall less than about a year old, and some are just about a month old or a few months old, they are already driving local coordination and change. Those local hubs are shepherded and shepherd the early learning vision in their community. They're shepherded by committed people in those communities, and you'll hear from some of those people today. This work is community and people-centric. These individuals that you're going to hear from today and their colleagues across the state are already starting to transform early learning in Oregon. We've come a long way since the creation of the Early Learning Council, and we have a long way to go. But I believe that we're firmly on a path toward a true early learning system, not an accretion of separate programs and organizations. So I urge your support of Senate Bill 213. We need a permanent approach for these determined individuals in their communities so that they can continue to work for change and change the trajectory for our underserved children and families.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pam. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director for the Early Learning Division. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 213, which establishes the Early Learning Hubs as permanent by amending a previous statute and removing the label demonstration project for the hubs. There are several members of the public who are here today to testify in support of the bill, and I really want you to hear their voices and hear what the hubs mean for them and their communities. So I'm going to be as brief as possible, but my job today is to brief you as a committee on four key points: what the hubs are and what they're charged with doing, the process and timeline by which the hubs were established, just preview for you the metrics that the council has adopted for hubs and talk a little bit about our recommendations for the future of the early learning hubs. And I will do that speedily because I really do want you to hear from the folks that traveled a ways to come and talk to you today. So the hubs were created to make sure that resources and supports are more available, more accessible, and more effective for children and families who have historically been overrepresented in our state's opportunity gap and underrepresented in terms of access to services. And the hubs are really tasked with working together with the state, with the division and the Early Learning Council, and this body to build a more coherent and cohesive early learning system out of what, as Pam referenced, has traditionally been a patchwork of programs and services on the ground. And House Bill 2013, passed in the 2013 session, gave the Early Learning Council and Division the authority to establish early learning hub demonstration projects. The statute allowed us to establish no more than 16 hubs. We could establish up to 7 in the first year of the biennium and up to 9 more in the second year. That's one reason why so many of the hubs are still in such an early stage of their development. The statute also laid out basic requirements for the hubs, including requirements for governance and who needs to participate in the work of the hub, a 15% cap on administrative overhead, and direction to the Early Learning Council to establish metrics. At the simplest level, the hubs really have 4 core responsibilities. They are charged with identifying the population of children in their communities who are the most at risk of arriving at kindergarten unprepared, and then working to identify the needs of those children and their families. Working across sectors, across health, human services, early childhood, K-12, and the private sector to connect those children and families to services that will meet their needs, and then to account for outcomes collectively across the system. Broadly speaking, the hubs are responsible for working with the state to make sure that the early childhood system is coordinated, aligned, and family-centered, that children arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed, and that families are healthy, stable, and attached. And we'll come back to these goals in the metrics section. The hubs are really working to create regional strategies for how to support the focused population of children across the birth through school continuum for the first time in our state. One of the main reasons, again, Pam alluded to this, that we need these locally based coordinators is that our system to date has been a very loose collection of programs and services. And the problem with that approach, although we have wonderful programs and services in this state, is that it relies on the people who need these services finding their way to them, and then it relies on the program or service having a slot open when they do. And that's a problem because there are a large number of children, about 25% of our under 5 population in this state, who are exposed to risk factors that impact their development and their readiness for school. And further, we've estimated that we're only serving about 12.4% of our under 5 population in our state's formal early learning services right now, the ones that the department that I run administers. We're able to serve 12.5% of our under 5 population. And so, of course, the hubs, a year into their existence, don't solve all of those problems, but they really set us up to go a long way toward solutions because they have the ability to hone in on what the challenges and problems are locally in a way that we never can do from the state level, and then to convene partners around local problem solving, which you're going to hear about in some of the upcoming testimony, and then pushing for and helping resource innovation and connection. Over the last year, we've developed 16 early learning hubs. The oldest signed its contract with us 11 months ago. The youngest signed its contract with us in February. This map shows you where they're located. The entire state is covered in terms of service areas. Our staff are currently working with 3 final regions to bring their strategic plans and their governance models into a place where the council can approve a contract with them. One thing that's just really interesting to note about the way that this system has developed is that the organizations and the people who have stepped forward to lead this change and build the hubs are really different and diverse across the state. Lead organizations include a CCO, a community college, several nonprofits, a community action agency, 2 county governments, and a handful of ESDs. Since the legislation called upon the council to develop metrics that the hubs could be accountable to, I wanted to just touch on what that looks like for you. In January, the council adopted a set of metrics that were developed by a group of hub leaders partners and measurement experts over the course of 6 months. They lay out our long-term desired outcomes and then stage out shorter-term outcomes, things that we could expect to see in the next 1 to 2 years while we're working toward larger population-level impact in years 3, 4, and 5. And all of the metrics that we developed were developed through the lens of these principles that you see in front of you, and I'm happy to go deeper into that at another time. So just to take a quick look at the metrics that we have developed, our first goal, a system that's aligned, coordinated, and family-centered. When we really make that come true, the outcome that we'll see is a common vision and agenda for our focused population of children, strong leadership across all 5 sectors, and ultimately disparities in accessing services will be reduced. On this slide, you can see what we'll be looking for from the hubs over the course of the next biennium in terms of commitments they'll make to the state and their contracts. Our second goal is that children are supported to enter school ready to succeed. And ultimately, for us, that means that disparities in performance across the domains of school readiness that are measured on the kindergarten assessment are reduced. We know that's an outcome that's going to take a while to move. So for this next biennium, these items on the screen in front of you are what we'll be holding the hubs responsible for. We really worked with our committee to develop short-term metrics that would incentivize the kind of collaboration across different kinds of partners that gets us to a place where we're starting to close disparities at kindergarten entry and ultimately for third grade reading. And then our third goal is that children are raised in healthy, stable, and attached families, another goal that will take some time to really work toward as a state. For us, when we reach that goal, it means that families will have support to access high-quality health services, that parents and families will have the confidence, knowledge, and skills to support healthy attachment and positive development of their children, along with the adequate resources needed to meet their needs around housing and transportation, and that working families have access to safe and affordable childcare that promotes healthy child development. In the short term, over the course of the next couple of years, these are the metrics that we'll be holding the hubs responsible for. Additionally, I want to note there's a group working to develop measures across health, human services, and education for child well-being. And as that work develops, we'll be weaving it into the work that the hubs are doing as well.
And Megan, I just wanted to give you a time check. Yeah. We have 13 people signed up and about 40 minutes left.
Great. So I can be done on this slide.
All right.
As the hubs move into from startup into true implementation, we have developed a set of recommendations for what we think needs to happen next to set them up to be successful. You can read them in the slide deck on OLIS. The one that I want to draw your attention to is the very first one. It's the one that this committee is called upon to consider, which is to give the legislature or to give the early learning hubs permanent statutory status. You'll hear from 13 people behind me about why we think that's the right thing to do. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, we're going to hold questions just so that we can get through folks. And as people are thinking, just so we can get to everyone, we'll do the timer of about 3 minutes per person. If that's problematic, let me know. So our first group is Sue Miller, Zeke Smith, and Julie Manning. And on deck, we'll have Judy Newman, Susie Linsmaner, and Campos. That is really loud.
All right.
Welcome. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sue Miller. I'm the chair of the board of directors for the Early Learning Hub serving Marion County, soon to be Marion and Polk. And also I chair the Oregon Community Foundation Board of Directors. So I want to talk about both of them very briefly. I've been in the early childhood world for a number of years. I was the executive director of the Relief Nursery in Marion and Polk counties for 12 years. So I've seen some of you with a different hat on. So I know there's great work being done in early childhood and has been for years, but we still don't have children ready for kindergarten, so something needs to change, and I think that's where the hubs step in. We're seeing transformative changes in the way that the different providers are working together. From an OCF perspective, the foundation, we've seen the difference that cross-sector collaboration makes in the parenting hubs that we have established in the entire state. state, and that's been over 4 years. So we know the collaboration makes a difference. Locally, two quick examples. One is to have early childhood providers at the same table as the K-12 teachers has made a huge difference. We now have kindergarten teachers, preschool teachers, child care providers all sitting down together talking about curriculum, talking about professional development, how to get parents engaged, and how to make transitions into kindergarten smooth for these families. Those conversations never happened before, but now they're all on our board of directors together, so they're building those relationships. The other quick example is in the cross-sector relationships between healthcare and early childhood also. You may be familiar with a developmental screen that has been used for years by early childhood providers and others. It's called the Ages and Stages Questionnaire, ASQ. So it's used to identify developmental delays early in children so they can be addressed. Historically, there's not been a system whereby those administering that screen could get the information into the child's chart at the medical provider. And that, of course, is a really key part because it's the medical provider that then makes the referrals and oversees the remediation. We are now, as a hub, putting together a system whereby the ASQs are going to be involved in as a part of the medical record for the children. So it took that collaboration between the having the CCO executive on our board, along with the major physician representative group and the county health department director, all sitting down working with early childhood providers to make sure that that happens. Two quick examples of why I strongly support Senate Bill 213. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. Thank you for providing the opportunity for us to offer our support for Senate Bill 213. My name is Julie Manning. I'm from Corvallis, and together with Lincoln County Commissioner Bill Hall, I co-chair the Early Learning Hub that serves Lincoln, Benton, and Linn counties. I work for Samaritan Health Services, which is a regional health system based in Corvallis, and I represent our region's CCO on the hub board. Although our board has only been meeting since last October, already we have seen tangible benefits from our regional collaboration. This includes receiving a grant from the Northwest Health Foundation to facilitate outreach to local families about the work of the hub, and receiving funding from the CCO to support the development of the hub's website and other communication tools, as well as related public awareness strategies. The CCO views the hub as a critical partner in its efforts to foster healthy children and families. This year, the CCO will provide funding to the hub to help achieve a common goal of connecting 98% of eligible families to a patient-centered primary care home. The collaborative structure of the hub provides an ideal framework for this work to take place and increases our overall opportunities for success. In my previous role as mayor of Corvallis, I've worked with Commissioner Hall in other regional efforts involving local government, social services, and economic development, and we have seen firsthand how these collaborations facilitate innovative thinking, leverage our area's unique resources, and develop more comprehensive solutions than any one entity could achieve on its own. In bringing the various partners to the table together, we can learn from one another and help ensure that we're solving problems in a way that raises all boats and is not duplicative of services already being provided within the region. It also goes without saying that this type of work is often more cost-effective and elicits greater buy-in among the participating organizations and individuals. Additionally, the agreed-upon solutions benefit from the leveraged communication tools available by enlisting all the participants and their respective constituencies in that important process. Again, this also saves valuable resources. We have every reason to believe that making our regional early learning hubs permanent through Senate Bill 213 will show equally positive results, and we encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, other committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Zeke Smith, and I am the Chief Impact Officer of the United Way of the Columbia Willamette in the Portland Metropolitan Region. In this role, I have the privilege of acting as a co-convener for two of our early learning hubs in the state, Early Learning Multnomah, in partnership with the Department of County Human Services, and Early Learning Washington County, in partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services. At the United Way, we are focused like a laser on breaking the cycle of childhood poverty and are leaning into this challenge with our money, our relationships, and our problem-solving capacity. I want to share briefly how the early learning hubs have provided an ideal platform for us to engage in this work and how this is visible in what we've been doing. In defining the nature of early learning hubs and the entities that convene them, SB 213 reaffirms the importance of authentic parent and private sector engagement, alongside that of other critical public sector partners like Health and Human Services, K-12 educators, and of course, early learning providers. In Multnomah County, we share this commitment to engagement of the private sector and of local parents, particularly those from the communities most affected by our current inadequate system of care, communities living in poverty, of color, and who have recently immigrated to this country. Momentarily, you will hear from Lupe Campos, who works at one of our culturally specific partners, the Latino Network, and from one of the parents in our Parent Accountability Council, Lydia Gray Holyfield. I appreciate that each were able to make the time to be here today and share their perspective on the value of the hub. Additionally, you've received written testimony from leaders at the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, Kairos PDX, the Latino Network, the Native American Youth and Family Center, and Self-Enhancement, Inc., all additional culturally specific partners of our Early Learning Hub. I point these testimonials out as they are evidence of the ways that our hub have taken the notion of parent and community engagement to heart. While this aligns with our values in Multnomah County and at the United Way, the hub has been an ideal mechanism for actualizing this engagement and turning it into new approaches to addressing the needs of the youngest kids and their families in our community, particularly those for whom existing strategies have been least effective. So what does this look like on the ground? An example. Through a grant from the Early Learning Division, our hub was able to work with four community providers representing Black, Native, Latino, Vietnamese, and Russian communities, and the Multnomah County Library to produce culturally specific and language-appropriate materials, providing families with easy-to-implement tools and strategies for supporting literacy skill development. On the surface, this looks like 4,000 families from these communities receiving relevant, appropriate supports that they can use with their families, all built on proven strategies from the library. On a deeper level, this represents placing the needs and the expertise of our communities of color at the center of the solution, ensuring these materials are not just translated, but are uniquely built on stories, songs, and practices that are known and recognized within each of these specific cultures. This isn't just about translating Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star into other language. This is a story about new tools and tactics in traditionally underserved communities, but also of systems change that recognizes our best solutions most often reside within the same communities we're trying to serve, and our hub is dedicated to looking there first. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. I appreciate your consideration of SB 213 and hope you will affirm the importance of parent and community voices by making our early learning hubs permanent.
Thank you all very, very much. So next we've got Judy, Sui, and Lupe, and following that we'll have Mary, Diana, Sabina, and Lydia. Welcome.
Chair Gelser and members of the Senate Human Services and Early Childhood Committee. It's a mouthful. I'm Judy Newman, and today I'm wearing two hats in this hearing. One is as the co-director of Early Childhood Cares, which is an early intervention, early childhood special ed program. I'll call EIECSC for speed. And the other is as being a member of the leadership and the governance of the Lane Early Learning Alliance, which is Lane County's early learning hub. So I wanted to share with you today that at the local level, it's important to know that EIECSC programs are involved in the development and implementation of the early learning hubs in every community around Oregon and often in leadership positions. I want to highlight two really specific areas of collaboration that have really been beneficial, very rich experiences, and benefited kids, families, and providers. My first example is in the area of early developmental screening and linking children to services. So the early learning hubs have a shared metric with CCOs to increase the rates of developmental screening for children under 3 years of age. Now, this is a really fantastic shared metric. It means that the children who need help are being identified earlier and getting help earlier. The EIECSE programs receive referrals from physicians from when there's a developmental delay suspected or identified, and that there's services available for them. In my program in Eugene, just in the December count, our referrals for the youngest kids jumped by 10%. And this increase really matches what we're seeing in the quarter reports from our CCO Trillium. Those numbers of developmental screenings done by physicians are really growing very quickly, and I believe it's because of this collaboration and focus. And similar increases are being reported in most areas across the state. This is great news for kids because we're identifying needs and linking them to services at an earlier and earlier time. My second example is a really important collaboration also around the work with the Quality Rating and Improvement System, the QRIS, which is aimed at increasing the numbers of quality childcare and preschool settings in every community. Now, these quality settings provide opportunities for children also with developmental delays and disabilities to learn with typical peers. EIECSE professionals provide training, coaching, and support to childcare providers so they can learn how to successfully include kids with special needs. This is a win-win for childcare providers. It enables them to keep progressing in the quality tiered rating system and get more money and more kids. And for children with special needs, it gives them more settings to be able to, again, be educated. So these are just two examples I picked out. There are many more. And in my written testimony, I included those. But it's an exciting and encouraging time for the youngest kids in our state. And I'm very proud to be involved in this collaborative and transformational work. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Sue Linsmeyer. I'm from Yamhill County. I am the Executive Director of the Head Start of Yamhill County program, and I also serve as the co-chair with a representative from the McMinnville School District for our Early Learning Hub. And I'm also a member of our community care organization. I'm the only person with that group on that board that is not a medical person, and that's because our CCO has taken on the Early Learning Hub as the fiscal backbone, which has been very exciting for Yamhill County and those of us who really see that health and early childhood are all about outcomes, are all about prevention and intervention. This is a very exciting time for Head Starts across the state. Head Starts are celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. We've been, not we personally in Yamhill County, but across the country, have been doing Head Start services for 50 years. And one of the things that Head Start programs are mandated to do is to work with community partners to really serve the neediest children and families in the communities. And for years, we've been trying to do this, but haven't always had the buy-in of other of the sectors. It's always been hard to get the K-12 system to really understand what happens with people prenatally all the way until they're ready for school. And it's also been hard even for faith-based folks and community government sometimes, public health, and some of the business sector folks. So this has just been very exciting for Head Start. People have just been coming together at the table for the same reasons, and it's been great stuff. One of the things that we've done in Yamhill County, we've always had a waiting list with Head Start of Yamhill County, and when we started our early Head Start program, we were only funded to serve 48 children, but in one community alone, we had 100 kids on our waiting list that were eligible. So with that, we developed what is called the Family Corps, and it's a universal referral system where anybody from the community, and usually, well, in the beginning, it was medical providers, can recognize there's a family that might need some home visiting services to help them to have a stronger beginning in life so they are ready for school and life. And those folks can make referrals to this family core, which is made up of all of us in the community who do home visiting. And we sit down once a week and we look at the referrals that come in and try to figure out who can serve these kiddos. And it used to be that we were just getting these referrals from medical partners, but now we get them from neighbors and from elementary school teachers. And we even got one last week from somebody from the representative side, from one of their staffers. So we figure that's pretty good business. One of the exciting things that's happened as a result of the Family Corps is our CCO is now funding a position. So there's somebody that can regularly staff that and really help families when they're calling in, especially when they're in crisis. So thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelsler, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lupe Campos, and I'm here as the Assistant Director of Early Childhood Programs for the Latino Network in Portland, Oregon. As a culturally specific organization, our early learning programs are designed to engage Latino parents and prepare our youngest children for success in school and life. For the past 15 years, our Juntos Aprendemos program has forged strong connections between Latino families and schools, strengthened parents' skills and confidence as their children's first teacher, and developed key kindergarten readiness competencies among low-income Latino children in our community. Our local Early Learning Hub is a key partner with us in this important work. Through the Community Education Worker Project funded by the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Grant, the hub has helped us to leverage the effective service delivery model and skilled staff of our Juntos Aprendemos program to expand supports for families of young Latino children and build bridges with their local schools. The story of the Community Education Worker Project illustrates how our Early Learning Hub has partnered with community-based organizations to elevate parent voice, build upon what is working well in communities of color, and align resources to address community needs. On a hot summer afternoon, in an apartment complex in Northwest Portland, Latino Network hosted a parent advisory session to generate strategies that would be effective in improving kindergarten readiness. During this conversation, a mom suggested, "Why don't you train people like us, people from the community, who come from the same background as the people you are trying to reach, so that we can share the information with other parents in our communities, you know, like they do in Juntos Aprendemos." This strategy became one of over 90 strategies considered by the Ready for Kindergarten Collaborative of Cradle Career, and was one of the two that was moved forward to an action team. When the Early Learning Hub was formed, the hub leadership saw this as an opportunity to build upon the momentum of a community-driven solution to disparities in kindergarten readiness. The CEW project marks a strategic intersection of public health and early learning that places parent leaders from communities of color in the forefront as trained promoters of healthy child development and school readiness. Community education workers are now actively working in the Latino, African American, and Native American communities in three geographic areas in our county, providing home visits, school-based groups, and referral to wraparound services. Our learning hub has been instrumental in making this critical work possible. I urge you to support SB 213. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next up, we have Mary, Diana, Sabina, and Lydia. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Gelsler and members of the committee. My name is Mary Curtis Gramley, and I'm presently the director of the Southern Oregon Early Learning Services, which is the hub from Jackson and Josephine County. As someone who has worked in relief nurseries, with CASA, with teacher education, and in many, many early childhood classrooms, I want to speak to you about the important role that parents will play in the design of the programs and services that we provide through the hub. Parents are the most important people in the lives of children. Their voices are essential if we're going to understand the needs of children and families and how the community and various programs can respond to these needs. We cannot know of the disparities in service and how they affect a child's chances for success if we don't seek out parents in a respectful way and learn from them. Only by incorporating the voices of parents in our planning will we truly understand how to invest resources in the places where they can do the most good. In our Southern Oregon Hub, we have looked for a lot of different ways in which we can work with parents and support them and listen to them. We have two parents serving on our executive or governance council. They participate in the agency's development of, in the hub's development of policies, in strategic planning, in many aspects of our work. Parents are also participating in agency advisory councils, helping to make our programs and our strategies work better for them and for their children. But I think one of the most significant involvements is with a parent advisory group in which the parents take leadership roles. They plan events and projects, and they work to build strong parent support groups. One of our major goals is to help families become stable. And the families that we work with have multiple factors and challenges that make this sometimes difficult. From my own experience with hundreds of parents who have been receiving services, I have learned that we will be able to make the greatest and most sustainable changes in the lives of children and in our community if we understand the impact of the conditions that many families face and focus our efforts on the true needs and inequities that exist in our communities. It's a real pleasure to introduce two parents who have been involved with our hub that I've known for a number of years, working with them in other areas. They've come all the way from Medford to share their stories with you all, and I'm happy to introduce Diana Cooper and Sabina Vaughn, who is down at the other end.
Wonderful. Diana. Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Diana Cooper, and I'm from Medford, Oregon. I'm a parent on the Parent Advisory Council. So my background is that about 22 months ago, my husband and I were actively using heroin and cocaine, and we were living in a tent with our four children, who were 5, 3, 2, and 7 months at the time. And literally holding on by a thread at that point. So when I came into recovery 22 months ago, I had no idea what I was walking into. We willingly went to DHS and opened our own case, and still had no idea what we were doing. Wondering how I was going to be successful wasn't even a question at the time, because I didn't even know that I could get a few days clean. So success really wasn't on my mind. It just wasn't an option for me. It was never going to happen for me. Then I started becoming involved in my recovery. I had just enough willingness to sit in my seat and listen, and that was about all I could do. After a time, I realized that I could stay clean for more than a day, and it felt really good. The treatment program I was in started recommending different resources to me, and I sort of, at the time, blindly followed into them because I was just doing what was asked of me. So I became involved with the Family Nurturing Center, and I learned about PCIT. I started doing pain management, mental health therapy on top of my group therapy, couples counseling, couples group, infant baby massage, bonding and attachment, all these other amazing parenting classes. And still, after all these things, I was not able to see the outcome. I was still blinded by my addiction. Had it not been for the individuals that held my hand through that first year of recovery, I don't think I would have stayed engaged in those, and I would not be sitting in front of you for sure. I'm doing well. I'm on the right track. My husband and I, we have no intention of slowing down. But I'm truly one of the lucky ones. And I can speak for many of my friends and the people that I know very dear to me. I have a strong determination and willpower, but I am not a single mother and father. I do not have a history of relapse. And so there's a lot of things that I don't know, and a lot of advantages that I had going into it. So there are others, really many, that are still suffering and aren't so fortunate. Their children suffer, even as the parents are trying to clean up the wreckage of their past. You know, the children are still caught in the crossfire. So what I see in the hub is the coming together of agencies and individuals that will make a huge difference to these families. Every meeting is filled with talk of how we can better inform, you know, workers about trauma and how we can use this to better enable policies that are going to remove the barriers for the parents. And thank you for inviting me here, and thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Would you like me to go next, or?
It's completely up to you.
Why don't you go ahead? You're in front of my
microphone. Hi, my name is Lydia. Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lydia Gray Holyfield, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a part of the local Early Learning Hub. I'm also a community education worker, and my daughter started kindergarten this year. I am all about early learning. Our hub has a parent council call, PAC, and PAC has 12 parents who are African American, Somalia, Russian, Vietnamese, and Native American, and Latino. We work together to guide. We work together to write some guiding principles for our hub. And now I'm going to read them to you. Because our hub followers have 5 principles that we know we want to see positive changes in our country. Principle number 1, we are a priority population. This means we focus on children who are called at risk, but who are really have a full promise. Some families face racism, discrimination. Some families live in poverty. We want all children to thrive. Principle number 2, we work on equality. This means we work to make sure that the invisible is visible. Families with language and cultural barriers end up isolated. Finding the right teachers, staff, who are from our communities, and welcome us into the schools with respect, be kind. We want ideas. We have the idea that you need to see us and to hear us. We are here. We are equal. See us and please respect us. Principle number 3, we are parent-centered. This means there is nothing done about us without us. Understand what we are like to be a parent, get to know us, partner with us, see the success in our children. Hear our needs before you proceed. We are raising our children, and we are the best resource. Principle number 4, we create family engagement. This means we support families to support the children. We want to educate ourselves so we can move our community forward. Following through with commitments to parents starts early. Don't wait until the problem gets too big. Support us as we take our children, meet us where we are. Principle number 5, building a system coordination. This means we all work together to partner with families. We want a better community between parents and children, school partners, with communities, agencies, and parents. Learn from programs that work well in our communities. Use your wisdom. We want to work together. Talk to us and talk to each other. It takes all of us to make a difference in our children's lives. Thank you guys for listening.
Thank you. And can you email us a copy of those statement of principles? I think we should put it at our place in the Human Services Committee every single day.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Wow.
Good afternoon. My name is Sabina Vaughn, and I thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair, and the committee to speak to you today about the Early Learning Hubs. I am representing the Southern Oregon Early Learning Hub that covers Jackson and Josephine counties, and I'm from Ashland. A little history about myself and my family is that I am married. We are a blended family, and together we have 8 children. Our 2 eldest are 22 and 20 and are currently attending college. We have 1 child in high school, 2 in middle school, 2 in elementary school, and my youngest, who's 4, is in Head Start. Education, family, stability, and wholehearted attachment are extremely important to us. I'm a United States Marine Corps veteran who served 9 years on active duty from 1991 to 2000. My husband is currently on active duty orders in the Oregon Army National Guard and is an Iraq combat veteran. When I think of what the hub can mean for our communities in helping to enhance stable and attached families with children who arrive at our public school systems, able and capable and ready to learn, I reflect on my own experiences trying to navigate the support systems we already have in place. In 2009, my husband deployed to Iraq for a year-long tour. During his first month in country, for various reasons beyond our control, we were faced with an approximate 1/3 loss in our usual income. And before long, I needed to seek out support from the different agencies we already have in place to make sure we didn't lose our home, to provide assistance with utilities, and also to help with food through SNAP benefits. 6 of my children also needed mental health services at that time for the stressors of deployment. 2 of my children were diagnosed with Asperger's, a high-functioning form of autism. My home was an emotional chaos, and I worried constantly that the bottom would drop out, we would be hungry and homeless, and I also was worried about my husband in a hostile territory that I was all too familiar with. The task of accessing the services that are in place as supports and are intended to help was overwhelming. Even knowing which services I needed or qualified for was uncharted territory to me and was for each program a long and drawn-out process of phone calls, written forms to fill out, and face-to-face interviews. To each agency, I was repeating the same story, each agency needing new or slightly different information, none of which were aware of what other services I may need, which ones I was qualified for, or which ones that I had previously applied. Fortunately for me, I was not working at the time because this process became my full-time job. I had to lean heavily on family, friends to help do tasks and childcare for me, and while I was desperate to figure out which door to open next, my children were slowly declining and truly falling apart. This impacted their learning, their development, and their mental health. I worried constantly if I would qualify for the services I was applying for. I wondered if I had wasted time when often I was turned down for helps or services, and I wondered if some of the programs would even meet my needs. I even had the experience of being shamed by some agencies because I was newly pregnant. My experience was one of confusion, self-doubt, and exhaustion. It was like trying to navigate a labyrinth blindfolded. I kept wondering how people less capable were able to manage to take on this monumentous task. I vowed to myself that I would help anyone else who was trying to go through this process. It has taken me years to restabilize my family, and there are still struggles we face as repercussions of going through that experience. However, this is an amazing and hopeful time for us all here in Oregon. With the advent of the hubs, my difficult experience will be a thing of the past. With the agencies that are already in place and committed to helping people, they are now coming together and communicating more effectively and efficiently under a joint information system. Families and children will rapidly be able to receive all the services they qualify for with less man hours being expended from the agencies, going into filling out the same forms, asking the same drawn-out questions of families, and this oftentimes re-traumatizing them. The information families and agencies share will be able to instantly be viewed and accessed between agencies, and there will be no wrong entry into the process to access support systems. Less time will be spent by the family members already in crisis trying to figure out what it is they need and what hoops they have to go through to access them. Children with mental health needs or disabilities will be able to get all the support they need, and their parents will be connected to support systems and information to help their children thrive all at once, instead of having things piecemealed together as parents fumble along trying to do the best for their children. Parents will be able to access agencies that support them in best parenting practices. The parents I am connected to in high-risk groups in my community are thirsty for knowledge on how to be the best that they can be. With the hub, they will be able to learn how to be more self-sufficient.
And I have to ask you to summarize because I'm going to start losing members in about 1 minute and we'll
all right,
still have
I'm
another
so
panel.
Sorry.
That's okay. You're doing great.
I'm near the end here. Okay. When we have stable and attached families, when we have children that are getting their needs met and the children are able to learn and grow freely without the burden of toxic stress hindering their learning and development, they can become the amazing people that they are meant to be, and they can learn alongside of their peers more successfully. We are, in fact, creating more stable families, a more stable community, which in turn creates a more stable and growing economy. At the end of the day, the real stakeholders in this coordinated effort are the children and families that are being served. The stakeholders are me, and they are my children. I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. And really would like a copy of that principal statement. That was phenomenal. So next we have Colt Gill, Eva Ripito, and Lynn Hinion. And committee members, I will stay. I understand if you need to move on to your next commitments. Welcome. This is the last panel. And this is the last panel. This is the last three. All right. Welcome.
Should I start?
Nice to see you again, Colt.
Yeah, good to see you. So Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to provide information on what we think is a really valuable program. For the record, I'm Colt Gill. I'm the superintendent at Bethel School District in Eugene, Oregon. I'm also a member of the governance consortium of the Lane County Hub, the Early Learning Alliance, and I sit on the board of our CCO, and I'm on the steering committee of our Regional Achievement Collaborative, trying to pull all these entities together. I enthusiastically support Senate Bill 213 and the continuation of the hubs. It's critical that we continue the work that has begun in our local communities. We've undertaken efforts to align early learning systems, support families so that they can thrive, and ensure children are ready to succeed in kindergarten. In Lane County, we've formed solid urban and rural partnerships that support young children and their families. We focus on evidence-based programs that deliver outcomes for our most underserved populations. We have many programs in place, but one I'm most proud of is called KITS, Kids in Transition to School. KITS is a program developed in a partnership with the Oregon Social Learning Center, the United Way of Lane County, and a couple of local school districts. This program has now grown to serve children and communities across our county, and it's showing great outcomes in terms of preparedness for kindergarten. I passed this out earlier, and so you can take a look at that and see the outcomes that we're getting. These are results from just a 16-week program that occurs before and during the beginning of kindergarten. The program serves both children and their parents. With the continuation of hubs, programs like this could be replicated across the state. So all of us here know that a child's brain develops more in the first 5 years than at any other time in their life. This is the time to invest in our kids and support the systems that support them, their families, childcare, healthcare, and education. Reaching our state's 40-40-20 goal will require investing in children before they enter our school doors and continuing that investment throughout their K-12 experience to ensure they are college, career, and citizenship ready. Hubs help ensure this happens. They give our local community the responsibility and some incentive and outcome-based resources to ensure that the experiences a child has during those early years creates a strong foundation for future success. With these new partnerships, we're not only offering more focused and evidence-based supports, we're tracking outcomes for our students from early childhood through college. This is a first for Oregon, and it is a stellar example of the progress being made in Lane County. However, this is only possible because of opportunities that are brought to us by the hubs and the regional achievement collaboratives. The Lane County Early Learning Alliance Hub is changing the way we meet the needs of children and families in our community. The hub work is based on solid and proven practices, and now we have results to prove it's effective. I urge you to continue this transformation of our early learning systems in Oregon. Oregon legislators, I don't think, will authorize another dollar this session that has a better return on investment for our children or the future of our state. I think when Oregon's children thrive, Oregon's future flourishes.
Thank you very much. Eva.
Hi, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Thanks for opportunity to testify on SB 213. My name is Eva Ripito, and I'm here today as an Early Learning Council member and in my role as political coordinator for AFSCME Council 75. AFSCME represents licensed in-home child care providers, employees of two head starts in the state, and others who interact with the early learning system. from early intervention, public health, and other services as well. As a council member, I was a little bit skeptical of the hubs. While I understood and still do understand the need to create a structured and supported early learning system, I had reservations. First was the hesitation to support changes that impacted people's jobs and lives. You immediately heard about impacts to those who were county employees that may have been impacted by this switch. So I had that reservation. And the second, more persistent hesitation beyond that, or that was that I wasn't sure if what we were doing was going to work. But as the hubs began to roll out, all involved adopted the lingo the Early Learning Council and the legislature had established, and some applicants could identify on paper who their partners should be to achieve our goals for an early learning system. However, what I wasn't hearing from people on the ground that those connections were being made. And perhaps my expectation was that if the hubs knew who they should have at the who should be at the table, that the invitations had already been made. So my skepticism has eased, and I can now say that I'm cautiously optimistic, and all these stories have certainly helped make maybe even move me a little bit more. And I think that's the key. The more I hear from people, the better I feel about it. Our oldest hub is just over a year, and our newest one is 1 month old. And even though we have two that have yet to be contracted, I'm more confident in the process. And I'm hearing from providers in several areas about how they are being invited to meetings or how they've been asked to participate in professional development programs. The connections are beginning to be made, and there is a lot more work to do. I think the expectations that have been set in the legislature and the Early Learning Council have guided this process and kept us on track. And I know with certainty that the successes that we are seeing, especially in bringing our last two hubs to contract, are due to the hard work and leadership from our Early Learning Division acting director and her team, and of course all the hub directors as well. Now that our early learning system is coming together, we now need support and need to support and sustain it, and I urge you to support SB 213. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Well, I'm the last one. And I also came up from Medford, so I appreciate you all staying. My name is Lynn Henyon. I'm a longtime financial advisor and resident of Southern Oregon. I'm here today as a business leader and somebody actively engaged in Oregon philanthropy as a board member of organizations such as the Oregon Community Foundation, SMART, the Children's Institute, and as well as the Executive Committee of Governor Kitzhaber's 10-year plan for Oregon. The earlier testimony has been excellent, and I have just 2 points I wish to underscore. One, there is no better investment we can make than an early learning and early intervention. And the coordination of services eliminates waste and duplication and leverages investments made by philanthropy and state dollars. I'm tempted to repeat those. You've heard them all afternoon. Just remember, investment and coordination. There are numerous studies that show that every dollar so invested returns at least 8% year over year in savings in education, healthcare, corrections, you name it, and in providing economic stimulus through a better educated workforce and increased productivity. If I, as a financial advisor, could do that for my clients, I'd be happy. But let me tell you a little story about why I think Southern Oregon is fortunate to have such an outstanding hub under the leadership of Mary Curtis Gramling. Back in 2002, I was on the board of the Oregon Community Foundation when an Ashland resident, a rather reclusive curmudgeon of a man by the name of Reed Walker, died. Unbeknownst to all but his attorney, his will left a huge bequest to OCF to help break the cycle of poverty, especially among children in Jackson County. Through my work with the Walker Fund, which now makes grants totaling roughly $2 million a year to Jackson County nonprofits, I learned the importance of early childhood. But I also learned a few other things. The more we listen to experts, the better our grant making. Sorry, I lost my place here. The more those experts work together, the better our grant making. And the better our grant making, the better the efficiency and the better the outcomes. By agencies working collaboratively and delivering a uniform message tailored to our region and our local needs, confusion and competition for the same dollars were significantly reduced. I've heard some talk about, quote, waiting to see the effectiveness of the hubs before funding them. I contend that the hubs have no chance of being effective if not given the resources and the power to be effective. I appreciate your support of Senate Bill 213. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. And committee, thank you so much for staying. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 213 and adjourn the Human Services Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Services Committee.